Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Anna Mateo, and Mario Ritter. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. Renu Kator, the president of the University of Houston, is unlike most presidents of colleges and universities in the United States. For one thing, she was born in India, and she did not speak any English when she arrived in the U.S. at the age of 18. Kator came to the American state of Indiana in 1974. At that time, her husband was earning a doctoral degree from Purdue University. But Kator says she was not satisfied simply waiting for her husband to complete his education. She completed her own doctoral degree at Purdue in 1985 and began teaching political science at the University of South Florida. In 2008, Kator was appointed president of the University of Houston and chancellor of the University of Houston system. The system is made up of four universities. With the appointment, Kator became the first Indian immigrant to lead a major research university in the U.S. She also became the first female leader of the University of Houston system. Throughout her career, Kator says she has faced some difficulties making the same progress as others in her field because of her race and gender.
I have to fight a little bit harder. And I don't mind that because I think that built my character. But as I moved up, I made sure that other people who are coming behind me don't have to fight those similar kind of situations.
The American Council on Education, or ACE, studies issues of higher education. The organization says only 3 out of 10 college presidents in the U.S. are women, and only about 2 out of 10 are ethnic or racial minorities. The information came from its study of about 1,500 university and college presidents, released in June. Laurel Espinoza is a researcher and one of the lead writers of the ACE report. She says this lack of diversity is a major problem considering how diverse the students at U.S. colleges have become. In 2016, the U.S. Department of Education reported that more than half of the 20.5 million college students in the U.S. were female. Also, the number of African American college students increased from 11.7% to 14.1% between 2000 and 2015. The number of Hispanic students grew from 9.9% to 17.3% in that same time. Espinoza argues that university leadership can best serve this increasingly diverse population when they represent the kinds of students they are serving. Women and minority presidents would have a better understanding of the needs of students who are like them. But schools continue to favor older white men for president positions, she says. The ACE study shows the average age of an American college president is 62. About 25% have also been president of another college before accepting their current position. Espinoza notes that when schools only look for candidates with years of experience in administration, they are going to keep choosing the same types of people. But having years of experience does not necessarily mean a person will have the skills to deal with new issues in higher education, she says.
What we have to do is take actually a larger step back and think about what does experience mean, and are we defining experience in the right way? As the student body has evolved and even technology evolves, we're getting into a lot of new spaces that require different types of experience. It's not just you've been a president before.
Rod McDavis works with AGB Search, a company that helps colleges and universities identify presidential candidates. He was also the president of Ohio University for 13 years. As an African American man, he says the lack of diversity in college leadership is troubling. But he says it is also not fair to blame schools for wanting someone who is familiar with the responsibilities of running a school.
It's hard to fault a board for wanting the sufficient amount of experience. You have to look at what a person has done within the time he or she has served in a particular office.
McDavis admits that the way schools identify candidates can be limiting. First, a school's governing board must decide the qualities it wants in a president. Then, the board creates a search committee, including professors, administrators, and both current and former students. The committee then creates a list of possible candidates who possess the desired qualities. The majority of candidates on these lists are usually deans or provosts, McDavis says. Schools most often choose professors to fill these roles based on their records of research publication and service to the school as a whole. McDavis argues that many schools do not do enough to support women and minority faculty in moving their careers forward. So, search committees often find fewer women and minority candidates with leadership experience. That is why Diana Natalicio says it is important for more colleges and universities to create policies and plans to support diversity. Natalicio became the first female president of the University of Texas at El Paso in 1988 and has served in that role ever since.
Natalicio says young people need to see diverse leaders in order to believe they can reach those positions one day. These individuals send a signal to all students that they too can hope to be in these roles, Natalicio says. If everyone who is an administrator at the highest levels of universities around the country is a white male, that's not the kind of role model that women and minorities need to see in order to reach higher. Natalicio suggests that schools need to actively choose to diversify their lists of presidential candidates. Also, schools must work with younger, inexperienced faculty. They must guide them in making choices in areas like research and service work that will advance their careers. Otherwise, college leadership will stay the same, Natalicio adds, even while the students continue to change. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore the origin and history of American expressions and teach you how to use them. Today, we focus more on history than usage. We are going to answer an age-old question that may have been keeping you awake at night. Well, perhaps not. but it's still an interesting word story. The pronunciation of some words can cause trouble for people learning English. For example, words such as circle, sir, certainly, and surprise all sound as if they begin with the same letters, but they don't. Knowing language of origin for an unknown or new word, its roots, can help you pronounce the word the right way. Just ask any student who has ever competed in a spelling bee. One question that spelling bee contestants can ask the judges during the event is, what is the language of origin?
Nick Tenasti.
Nick Tenasti, will you please give me the language of origin?
It's made up of Greek elements that were probably first combined in German.
Nick Tenasti. N-Y-C-T-I-N-A-S-T-Y. Nick Tenasti.
Correct.
The development or evolution of a word over time can also play a part in how we say it. In fact, both origin and evolution are involved in the pronunciation of the word kernel. First, what does kernel mean? A colonel is a military official. In the United States, it can mean an officer in the Army, Air Force, or Marine Corps. Colonel is spelled C-O-L-O-N-E-L. So why do Americans say colonel as if it is spelled K-E-R-N-E-L? Adding to the confusion is that colonel is a word of its own, and one that has several meanings. But now let's get back to colonel, the C-O-L-O-N-E-L one. We know that many languages borrow and even steal words from other languages. The English language is probably the biggest thief of them all. It stole kernel from at least two countries, maybe even three. First, let's talk about Italy. By the 15th century, Italian forces were known for being good at war. So many Italian war terms spread across Europe, including the word colonel. It comes from the Italian word colonnello. This is the position given to the officer responsible for a small force or column of soldiers. Then there's the influence of France on colonel. The French also took this word from the Italians. But when they added it to their language, they changed the word colonnello to coronel. Language experts say this is because the French wanted to have the R sound in the word instead of the two L sounds. Finally, let's not forget Spain. At the same time, the Spanish were also pronouncing C-O-L-O-N-E-L as K-E-R-N-E-L. It is possible that both the French and the Spanish pronunciation affected the English version of the word. In addition to country of origin, there is something else at play in the word history of colonel: written versus spoken language. From the very beginning, when this word came into English in the 1500s, there were two versions of spelling and two pronunciations. By around the 17th century, the word began appearing in military treaties across Europe. So the written form of the word and the spoken were both being used. In English, a combination won out. Colonel was spelled C-O-L-O-N-E-L, but pronounced colonel. Please let me apologize from the bottom of my heart for our crazy and sometimes confusing English pronunciations. That's all for this Words and Their Stories. Join us again next week when we talk about more words and more expressions in American English. I'm Ana Mateo.
A species of army worm has spread to over 20 African countries and threatens Africa's main food crop, maize. The warning comes from the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. Joseph Husing works as an advisor to USAID. He suspects the fall armyworms were transported to Africa from the American state of Florida or islands in the Caribbean. Husing says the insects are attacking maize crops, also known as corn, in African countries south of the Sahara Desert. From Nigeria and Ghana all the way to South Africa to Ethiopia, he told VOA. The most recent one is South Sudan, which reported fall armyworm infestation toward the end of June. Husing thinks fall armyworms are a big threat to African agriculture. When they invade a maize field, he said, the insects can eat 30% or more of the crop. They also eat other crops. The fall armyworms got their name from fall or autumn, the time of year when they do the most damage in the northern United States. The first published report describing their presence in Africa appeared in early 2016. It suggested the insects had already been there for a year. For several reasons, the fall armyworms may pose more problems for farmers than the African armyworm, which is native to Africa. Fall armyworms can reproduce continuously under warm, moist conditions, says Yene Balena of USAID. He noted they can feed off of more than 80 species in 27 plant families. As adults, fall armyworms can fly up to 100 kilometers a day if pushed by winds. Some armyworms have found a ride on modern aircraft. For this reason, Balena said, communication is especially important. If there is an outbreak, for example, in Ethiopia, alerting Sudan or Eritrea would be a wise thing, he said. In fact, the insects are in Ethiopia. The country's Plant Protection Directorate reported that, as of July 10th, fall armyworms had infested more than 440,000 hectares of crops. It said that about 305,000 hectares had been protected, but chemical treatments may be less effective with the new invaders than with the African armyworms. The fall armyworm enters the plant and feeds from inside, says Balena. This makes the insect harder to recognize and harder to kill. The species is defenseless in cold weather, but freezing conditions are rare in much of Africa. Regina Eddy heads USAID's Army Worm Response Team. She says her team's goal is to provide training and technical choices. She identified Brazil as a model for fighting armyworms. A recent USAID report noted that Brazil spends an estimated $600 million each year to control the insects. One control measure experts are taking is to more carefully inspect food arriving at African airports. The fall armyworms may have arrived on the continent through a food shipment from overseas. The fall armyworm is not causing a crisis yet, but Belena told VOA no one is taking the situation lightly. I'm Mario Ritter.
This week on our National Parks journey, we visit a land of giants, high up in California's Sierra Nevada mountains. Here, you will find the largest living things on Earth, as well as the tallest mountain in the continental United States. You will also find the deepest canyon in America. Welcome to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park. The park gets its name from the area's ancient sequoia trees. They are among the oldest trees on the planet. Millions of years ago, different kinds of sequoias grew in many different places. Only two kinds exist today: the redwood and the giant sequoia. Both are found in California. Redwoods are taller, but the trunks of giant sequoias are much bigger. Sequoia National Park's forests are thick with giant sequoias. Many of the trees are several thousand years old. The largest is called General Sherman. It is named after a U.S. general in the Civil War, William Tecumseh Sherman. The tree is 31 meters around. It stands almost 84 meters tall, and it continues to grow. It sits within the park's giant forest. The forest is home to over 8,000 sequoia trees. General Sherman is more than 2,200 years old. It is the world's largest tree in terms of the amount of wood it contains. The National Park Service says if the tree were cut down, it would provide a huge amount of wood construction planks. It says if they were laid end to end, they would stretch for almost 200 kilometers.
In the late 1800s, people grew concerned about logging activity in the area. They sought to protect the giant sequoias from being cut down for wood. One of those people was Walter Fry. In 1888, he came to the Sierra Nevada Mountains as a logger himself. He spent 5 days with a team of loggers trying to take down a single giant sequoia tree. Fry then decided to count the tree's rings to learn its age. The answer shocked and saddened him. The tree they had cut down was more than 3,200 years old. He and his team of loggers had ended thousands of years of growth. The experience led Fry to change jobs. He became a naturalist. He studied the trees and measured the size of fallen sequoias. He also joined the fight to protect them from future loggers. When a petition was created to urge Congress to create a national park in the area, Fry was the third person to sign it. Sequoia National Park was established on September 25, 1890. It became the country's second national park after Yellowstone.
In 1940, Congress established another park near Sequoia, Kings Canyon. It and Sequoia National Park have been managed together since 1943. Kings Canyon is home to the deepest canyon in the United States, as well as a famous sequoia forest called Grant Grove. Here, you will find the world's second biggest tree, the General Grant Tree. It is over 3,000 years old. Along with the world's biggest trees, the area is also home to one of America's highest peaks, Mount Whitney. It measures 4,414 meters. It lies in the eastern part of Sequoia National Park. While many visitors travel here to witness the giant sequoias, some visitors also come here to climb Mount Whitney. The climbing trail itself begins at an elevation of over 2,400 meters, already very high for some people. Many hikers experience altitude sickness while trying to reach the top. More than 30,000 people try to climb Mount Whitney each year. Only about 10,000 reach the top. Of course, the park offers less extreme hikes as well. One of the most popular is the Morro Rock Trail. Morro Rock itself rises more than 2,000 meters. But hikers only need to climb the final 90 meters to reach the top. From there, they are rewarded with stunning views, the towering Sierra Nevada mountains, and kilometers of giant sequoia forests. Climbers also get a view of the 90-kilometer-long Kaweah River, which runs through a deep canyon.
Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park is home to a richly diverse animal world. More than 300 species of wildlife live in the park. Mammals include the tiny white-footed mouse, the gray fox, and the bobcat. Black bears are also common. Bird species include the California quail, the northern owl, and the acorn woodpecker. There are also many animals that swim, slither, hop, or crawl. Visitors might see a northern Pacific tree frog, a western pond turtle, or the colorful rainbow trout. If you are lucky, you will not run into one of the park's poisonous wild rattlesnakes. But do not let bears and snakes scare you away. Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park is too extraordinary to miss. The words of the late naturalist John Muir perfectly describe a visit to this great park. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.